Hello, I'm Mike Thompson, reporting from Israel. Over the next hour, I'll be telling the story of the lives and deaths of Naftali and Mohammed.
Israeli soldiers pouring into the occupied West Bank on the hunt for three missing teenagers. Israel says the boys have been kidnapped. The missing are 19-year-old Ayal Ifrach, Naftali Frenkel and Gilad Shire are both 16.
Naftali and Mohammed, one Jewish, the other Arab, were two of the four innocent boys kidnapped last summer. Who were they? And what do their lives tell us about the people caught up in the enduring conflict? In the first half of the programme, I'll be talking to the Frenkel family about their 16-year-old son, Naftali.
This is from the day before the murder. This is Naftali, this is Gilad, that was murdered with him. And they were on a field trip, just having fun with the kids. Very sporty, very good student, yeah.
With his four sisters.
It's fun.
The one there with the tongues all out.
Yeah, he's tickling his sister.
Raheli and Avi Frenkel are the parents of seven children, three boys and four girls. 16-year-old Naftali was their second oldest child. The family live halfway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, in a place called Nof Ayalon, in central Israel, which straddles the 1949 armistice line. Gathered around their large dining table, in a room filled with the signs of children, Avi and Raheli show me some of their family photos and videos of Naftali.
That's also from a field trip.
That's the same.
He's playing a little...
It's actually the ukulele.
Ukulele, right? A little guitar.
Very musical.
Sang very nicely, very good.
Sang in a choir. He played the guitar. He played the recorder.
He had a teacher for the flute. He liked it. He practiced. And then when he got older, he wanted to learn more. He still learned with the teacher. He taught him a few guitar lessons. And then he started teaching himself. Started learning from the YouTube. Took like lessons.
During the last year, he became very proficient in guitar, like all kinds of music styles and music theory and harmonizing and chords, and invested a lot of time in it when he had time from school and from sports.
Naftali was studying at a yeshiva or religious school for boys. Although the family described themselves as strongly religious, they are not ultra-Orthodox Haredi, whose menfolk are known for their long black dress coats and large hats. The Frankels do not live on a settlement, but Naftali had chosen to go to Mekor Haim School, which is situated in a settlement in the controversial Gush Etzion area of the West Bank. Naftali was a boarder at the school, so, like many of his friends, he would usually go home for the Sabbath. But with few buses or other public transport, he and his friends would often have to hitchhike there. Although this form of travel can be both unreliable and risky, particularly for Israelis on the occupied West Bank, many people use it as a way to get around.
His school is 15 minutes south of Jerusalem, and that's considered part of the West Bank. There it's a whole bunch of Jewish settlements. There's a city there, the whole area, Gush Etzion. And between those places, there are no buses going. I mean, it might be once a day or nothing practical. So the common thing is to take rides with people that move there from one place to the other. And they were actually on their way home. So they were looking to go out of that area to the Tel Aviv area. You know, even in this place where we live, there are no buses. Either you have someone driving you around and teenagers already take rides.
But you never tried to dissuade Naftali from hitchhiking back from school in that area?
We actually, when his older brother started school there, we for about a year we tried to keep them, and we realized it's not practical. It's just very, very hard to get around and to get home. And it would take him, you know, he'd probably have to wait for the next day to get home.
At this point, Avi, a lawyer with the civil service, leans forward and starts to tell me how his family's nightmare began back on the 12th of June last year.
It was Thursday. I actually spoke to him in the afternoon when I came back from work. He said that they're finishing a trip, it was the end of school, and I understood that he's coming the next day. We were here at home, and then he texted us an SMS message that he is coming tonight. It was around 9:30. I saw the message at around 10:30 because we went to sleep early. And I wrote, excellent, we're happy. The next thing is 3:30 in the morning. We have a policeman knocking on the door over here. Gilad's parents were looking for him. They didn't know what's going on. They called people they know. They were told that Naftali and Gilad left school together. So they wanted to know, maybe Gilad is here. So I said, yeah, okay, I'll go up to the room. And I went up and Naftali wasn't there. I went down, Naftali wasn't there. Tried to phone him. There was no answer, and then I understood that it's not good. That's not the Naftali I know. But 4 o'clock in the morning, I met Gilad's father, Ophir. We actually drove to Gush Etzion early Friday morning to see what we can gather there, information and so on. And as time passed, we understood it's what we think, it's serious. Only later during the day we understood that there was a third guy together with them, Eyal. And since then, we were here at home, since that Friday noon.
The fact that the three boys had been abducted on the West Bank meant that finding them was a job for the army or Israeli Defense Force. Under international law, the West Bank is occupied territory, but many Israelis, like the speaker you're about to hear, still see it as part of Israel and use biblical language to describe it. The IDF's Major Itzeh Godon was the coordinating officer for what was known as Operation Brother's Keeper. I met him at a leafy barracks close to Tel Aviv.
It was Friday morning. I was celebrating my anniversary with my wife in Tel Aviv. I got the news from my friends in Judea and Samaria. They told me that something bad was happening. And I looked at my wife and I told her, I'm sorry, we need to stop the celebrating now because something bad was happening in Judea and Samaria. I remember she asked me what happened and I didn't know if I can tell her or not. So we've turned home that day, and in the way home, there was on the radio an announcement that there are three kids that they were kidnapped.
When we realized that we're looking in the Hebron area, it became an army operation and the intelligence and Shin Bet. So the army, the police was involved, but it was mostly directly through the IDF.
There was here a group from the IDF, from the army. It's a group that is in contact with the family in such cases, if there's any hostage situation. And they were actually in our backyard, and we got the information from them. That was our line of communication. They didn't tell us everything, but whatever they told us was 100% true. And when you don't know exactly what's going on, it's very important you get real information.
We thought or that Hamas is holding them in Judea and Samaria, or somebody took them to Gaza. But finally, we focused on Judea and Samaria. That was the point. We've searched all the 2 weeks, and we believed that they were there.
We pretty quickly understood it's a hostage situation. There was a lot of intelligence to support that. And we were waiting for their location to be found and either an operation or negotiations. We understood it might take a while, but, you know, every morning we had a new hope that something will happen.
And how was your family dealing with this? What were you saying to Naftali's brothers and sisters?
Telling them the truth. Telling them the truth, each one according to his age and understanding. But The big ones knew what was going on. The smaller ones knew he was lost and were looking for him.
The first day I told my six-year-old that we're looking for him, and he got lost and everybody is looking for him. She burst out crying and she said, also, Ope, our dog got lost and he never came back again. And this is Naftali and Ope. And we were looking for him for a while, for the dog. So it was a good equivalent for her. She also ended up to be right.
The search was focused around Hebron, a mainly Palestinian town in the West Bank. This was where signals from the boys' phones had been traced to. And the security forces lost no time in searching, and in some cases destroying, the homes of known Hamas members there.
All the IDF operation were against Hamas. The houses that we visited were only houses related to Hamas, and we thought will help us to understand where the children are. This was in our mind, just where are the children are.
A vital piece of evidence in the hands of the security forces was a recording of an emergency phone call made by one of the kidnapped boys soon after their abduction. 16-year-old Gilad's words, which are followed by muffled gunfire, are hard to make out. You may find what you're about to hear disturbing.
At some point, we heard that tape. That wasn't very easy. We heard the voices. We were explained the sounds of the shots were muffled. We didn't recognize Naftali's voice. That made it a little bit more calm. Though, you know, thinking of Gilad's parents, I was scared how they'll feel listening to the tape because you can hear Gilad's voice there. And he actually, you know, he was a hero of sorts, picking up the phone and making the phone call. Through that call, there was a lot of intelligence information, some of which was the fact that there were weapons in the car and there were shots. And dealing with that was complex because it really left all options open. And everybody was very honest with us. And they said, you know, they might all three be dead, or maybe it was shot just to scare them so they cooperate. And maybe somebody's wounded, and maybe there's one, and all the options are open, and we're assuming that there are alive people to be found, and we're working under that assumption.
Today we know they were murdered that night, 2, 3, 4 minutes after they went on the car, and they were buried, but maybe we wouldn't find them. So the efforts were fruitful, and we felt that they're doing the right things.
As a person, it was difficult because you hear the voice of shooting and you tell maybe it was just they shot near them or something like that, because we didn't know if they killed them all. Our hope, every soldier that searched the boys for a week in plain terrain, in no man's land, hope that the boys are alive.
Around 1,500 members of the Israeli Defense Force, along with many local people, took part in the search. The whole of Israel, along with the Jewish diaspora around the world, waited nervously for news. On the 17th day of the search, thousands turned out in Tel Aviv in a mass show of support for the Frankels and the families of the two other boys.
There was a rally in Tel Aviv, and I think over 80,000 people came. It was an amazing rally. It was all full of solidarity and love and optimism. The next day, we were on our way to a meeting, and we got a phone call saying, just come back. Go back home. We said, what's going on? They said, just go back home. We realized it can't be good news.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has promised to take revenge for the killing of three Israeli teenagers in the West Bank. They went missing while hitchhiking near a Jewish settlement.
We had there, like, all in all, about 30 minutes of... I felt my stomach was up in my throat. It's probably the hardest part to remember.
Finally, Lavi Battalion from the Kfir Brigade found him near the city of Hebron, Khalkhul, in a pit. Unfortunately, we found them, but they were dead.
What effect did the discovery of their bodies have on your search team?
The feeling is bad. And you could see the eyes of the soldiers. Some of them were actually crying because they was really believed that everybody was okay. And on the other hand, we searched for them for 18 days. There was a glimpse of joy that we could bring the boys to their mothers, and there is no comfort in this situation. But we were glad that we could bring them back.
Racheli and Abby now had the task of breaking the news to Naftali's brothers and sisters.
I have very harsh physical memories of those hours, of waiting for the news, of hearing the news, of telling it to my children. Probably the hardest thing I ever did.
Telling the children, taking them one by one and explaining to each one of them what happened. That was very hard. And decisions. Funeral, how and what, you know, it was three boys, if it will be together, if it won't be together. Those are not minutes and hours I really want to. Yeah, it's something you wish you would never go through.
And where was the balance between hearing in some ways what was the worst news and on the other hand, having finally knowledge of what had happened and some sort of resolution?
You know, when people said uncertainty is the worst thing, I constantly said I'd trade uncertainty for bad certainty any day. I am aware of the fact that, in a way, it's grace to have closure. But thank God, I can't imagine what it would have done to our family if this didn't come to an end. We were hoping for a different end, but...
When you get news that your son is murdered, then you know, that's it. It's the end of the world. It sits somewhere in the mind. You know that, in a way, it's very good that they found them. But at that time, you're filled with the grief and with the disaster of the main news.
I've come to visit Naftali's school in the large West Bank settlement area of Gush Etzion. It's very quiet here. There's just a few students walking in and out of a collection of modest-looking prefabricated buildings. Although life goes on with enthusiasm in this busy school, time is taken wherever you go to remember the missing teenagers. T-shirts worn by many of the boys are festooned with blue ribbons and Hebrew words dedicated to their memory. I'm warned that some pupils are still too upset to discuss their feelings, but one of Naftali's close friends has agreed to speak to me.
My name is Gabriel Ezem and I'm a senior in Makol Chaim.
What do you think you miss most about Naftali?
You've lost a friend. He's a person you can talk to openly, talk about the deeper things in life, not about who won the football game last week. We miss him in the group. We were a group of four, always talking, joking around, and he's not there. It's a hole. It's a real knock under the belt when your close friend has been taken. And you're looking for the reasons why. He would have been able to find the deeper reasons.
Can you think of any now?
I can just have to say it's part of a bigger picture. It's something bigger than us. The God is mysterious, what can I say?
Six months on, Racheli and Avi are still learning to live with the loss of their much-loved son.
keeping Naftali alive amongst us is a challenge. On the one hand, we want him to be there everywhere with the flow of the family and to always be present with us. On the other hand, we don't want to constantly remind ourselves of, you know, of the void. Which it's there. There's no way to avoid the void, but we don't want to pull down the mood. So it's, you know, it's a delicate balance, and we're learning. We're beginners.
Naftali's dead. We don't hide that, but we won't avoid mentioning him just because of that. You know, maybe if we won't say it, then maybe no one will remember he's dead. So he's there. He's there in his very specific way of being right now, but he's part of us. And I think that's the right way to continue.
My young daughter, Nama, saw me packing something and she said, do you still only put on your makeup when you get to work because you want to cry on the way? I said, you know, Nama, I don't cry every way on the way to work, but I reserve the right to cry on the way to work. So I put on my makeup when I get to work. It opened up the fact that the sorrow is part of our life, but it doesn't stop us from working or from looking pretty or from laughing together. And she knows it's there. And, you know, she's 6 years old.
What are you showing me, Nama?
In the garden of their home, late on a warm, sunny afternoon, I make one last visit to the Frankels. I find them playing in the garden with their younger children, among Racheli's seeds of hope.
During the search, everybody came with something. So a farmer from the south came over, and he brought a whole pack of sunflower seeds. And he said, when Naftali comes home, you sow them together, and you'll have, you know, many sunflowers in your garden. So we used some of them, maybe they'll last for a few more years. And that was already a little over two months ago. And before the new year. Mm-hmm. And we already have sunflowers in our garden, which is beautiful. And there are a few more I see popping up other places in the garden. And Naftali isn't here to see them, but we have flowers.
On September the 23rd, the Israeli Defense Force found and killed the two suspects, Marwan Kawasmi and Amar Abu Aisha, in a shootout. But the end of Operation Brother's Keeper marked the start of more violence to come. Join me after the news for part two of the lives and deaths of Naftali and Mohammed.
Documentaries on the BBC World Service.
Machado de Assis had little formal education, but his writing still admired and enjoyed more than a century after his death.
He is the greatest Latin American writer of the 19th century and the greatest Brazilian writer of all time.
My students are surprised that a writer from Brazil from the 19th century can still make them laugh.
Chapter 49, The Tip of the Nose. Did you ever ponder the function of the nose, dear reader?
I'll be heading out across Rio to retrace Machado's extraordinary life and discover just what the people of this vibrant and colourful city make of their literary star.
He's amazingly ahead of his time, a very subtle literary creator.
So join me, Juliana Iocci, for Remembering Rio, online at bbcworldservice.com.
Coming up in the second part of our special programme, The Lives and Deaths of Naftali and Mohammed, how a revenge murder helps spark an uprising in the West Bank, war in Gaza, and grief for the parents of a Palestinian teenager.
I wonder how they did it, what kind of a heart they had to do that. They meant to torture him, they meant to make him suffer.
Join me, Mike Thompson, after the news.
BBC News with Jonathan Izard. Royal officials in Saudi Arabia have announced the death of King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz. He was 90 and had been in hospital for several weeks, suffering from pneumonia. He's been succeeded by his half-brother Salman. King Abdullah came to power in 2005 when he succeeded another half-brother, Fahd. President Obama offered his deep condolences and praised King Abdullah's belief in the importance of the US-Saudi relationship as a force for stability in the Middle East. The Yemeni president, Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi, and his government have submitted their resignations in protest at the takeover by Houthi rebels of the capital, Sana'a. A Houthi leader has welcomed Mr. Hadi's decision and proposed setting up a presidential council to fill the political vacuum. The leader of the Greek left-wing party Syriza has asked for a clear mandate in Sunday's general election to enable him to implement his plan to end the country's austerity policies. Alexis Tsipras repeated his promise to have half of Greece's international debt written off when the current bailout agreement ends. Thailand's Attorney General is indicting the former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra for alleged negligence over a rice subsidy scheme, which opponents say cost the country billions of dollars and funneled money to her party's power base. A spokesman at the Attorney General's office said she will face criminal charges in the Supreme Court. She could face up to 10 years in prison. The mother of one of the two Japanese citizens held captive by Islamic State militants has appealed for the release of her son, Kenji Goto. She said he was not an enemy of Islam. Islamic State has threatened to kill Mr. Goto and another hostage, Haruna Yukawa, unless Japan's government pays a ransom of $200 million. One of the football stadiums built in Brazil for last year's Football World Cup has been closed for urgent repairs. Officials said they would need to spend more than $200 million on the stadium in Cuiabá to fix its roof and other installations damaged by heavy rains. That's our latest summary. I'll be back at the top of the hour with a full bulletin of BBC News.
Hello, this is Mike Thompson. Welcome back to part two of the lives and deaths of Naftali and Mohammed here on the BBC World Service. I'm telling the stories of two of the teenage boys whose murders led to the start of the Gaza War. In June, Naftali Frankel and two other Jewish schoolboys were kidnapped while hitchhiking in the West Bank and then killed. Just hours after the funeral for Naftali Frankel and his two teenage friends, Israeli jets hit a string of targets in Gaza in response to rocket attacks by Hamas. This had followed the searching of thousands of West Bank homes and the detention of more than 500 people. But it was to be the abduction and murder of a 16-year-old Palestinian boy that was to have the biggest impact on events that followed. It took place on the streets of East Jerusalem, which lay stretched out far below me here from my windy vantage point high on the historic Mount of Olives. The grief of the Frankels was soon to be shared by another family, this time a Palestinian one.
This is Muhammad's room, and this is his bag. This is his closet where he kept his clothes. This is also his stuff. He used to put silver chains here. He used to love these things. He would buy them and wear them, and so did his brother. These are all of his things. He used to love perfumes. He would take any perfume I had. All of this is his.
Mohammed Abu Qadir's mother, Suha, fights back tears as she shows me around her son's bedroom. Everything appears to be just as he left it. His various possessions, books, phone, scarf and tissues, neatly piled on his bedside table, defying the family's disordered clutter elsewhere in this seven-child household. It's as if Mohammed's short life is being preserved in Aspic.
Never in my life will I ever take these things out of here, because my son is inside my heart and will never leave. Nothing in the world would ever make me forget Mohammed, nothing at all.
Mohammed's father, Hussein, remembers how his son was loved and admired by their local community too.
Mohammed, will it be Shafat Han?
Mohammed was born here in Shawat. He had a very strong personality. He was loved by people. He was loved in school and was one of the top students. He used to take part in all social events in the town. His strong personality meant he was very different from all of his siblings.
I'd always know when Muhammad was back from school. First, before he comes back from school, he calls me and asks me what we're having for lunch. Then he says, prepare the food, I'm coming. Even when I'm in the kitchen, I hear my son's voice the moment he steps through the main gate downstairs, because he sings for me. He would keep singing from downstairs until he comes into the house and doesn't stop. That was his nature. He loves fun 24/7. He doesn't like to see me sitting still. He would always lighten the mood in the house. He would joke and talk with the family. His moves themselves were jokes.
Cuckoo, cuckoo!
Cuckoo, cuckoo!
Cuckoo, cuckoo!
In the same block as Mohammed's home is a child development centre for children with speech and learning problems. The head of this centre is Mohammed Odeh. Over the years, he got to know the very likeable and popular young Mohammed well.
I know Mohammed from the area as a neighbor, and I used to see Mohammed daily, maybe 10 times, 20 times. You know, he has something different from all the kids in this building, that every time he came down and up, he was singing. Even when he go up and downstairs, he do kind of music. Like he's jumping and dancing and singing at the same time. Even he's like this. You know that he is there always. You know, even his phone is all the time on kind of music. I like this side of Muhammad, you know.
And it seems Muhammad didn't stop at singing. He had a talent for dancing as well. His cousin and close friend, Hakim, showed me some video footage of a traditionally costumed Muhammad performing with his Palestinian folk dancing or Debka troupe.
Muhammad used to love the Palestinian folk dance of Debke. He used to dance a lot. Me, him and other six friends of ours, we had a group. We used to train together. We used to go to parties and dance together. And we used to do everything together. We never did something that Muhammad did on his own or me did on my own. We all went together to all these parties.
His friends have now renamed the dance troupe after him. Mohammed was training to be an electrician, just like his father, at a technology college on the other side of Jerusalem. In the light of tensions following the recent murders, I wasn't allowed in to speak to staff there. But one of his teachers, Mehias Hilman, agreed to meet me outside and told me about his favourite pupil.
My name is Mehias Hilman from Jerusalem. I used to be the main teacher of Muhammad Hussein Abu Khdir.
I've heard that he was quite a personality, that he liked to sing, he liked to make jokes, that he was a lot of fun. Can you tell me what he was like with you in the class?
Despite his good sense of humor, he was still interested in his class. No day has passed without students laughing at Muhammad's jokes. Some of them even recorded his voice on their phones. And even now, when they remember him or they hear his name, they put on the recording and they hear his jokes. But of course, this laugh has a tear behind it, and it's not like before.
Can you remember any of Muhammad's jokes?
For example, when he used to want to call a teacher, you usually address teachers by saying miss. But he would say bis, which in Arabic means a cat. So he would say bis, 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 and then she would turn and ask him, what did he say? And he would say miss, miss. But they know that he said bis, and he was joking with them. There was also a teacher whose name was Maryam, and there's a famous Arabic song for Maryam. And whenever he would see her, he would sing Maryam Maryam Ti, and he would sing that song for her.
How much is he missed?
I've been teaching for 5 years in this school. Every year, I would have a special student. And last year, I had Muhammad, and he left that space. Muhammad was good academically and good in every sense of the word. He is really missed.
I'm at a busy crossroads in the Arab neighborhood of Shafat in East Jerusalem. At this time of day, the street hums with traffic and the chatter of passers-by popping in and out of the small roadside shops all around me. But in the early hours of Wednesday, July the 2nd, this would have been a much quieter scene as 16-year-old Mohammed Abu Qadir waited on the corner here for some of his friends. They were all to go together to dawn prayers at the local mosque. And I'm walking there now, and it takes little more than 20 seconds. But before the friends got here, a car pulled up alongside the solitary Mohammed. Several men jumped out, grabbed the teenager, and pulled him inside. He wasn't seen alive again.
Mohammed went to pray in the morning. He listened to the first call of prayer and left.
Sitting beneath one of several large posters of Mohammed, which line the walls of the family's front garden, his father, Hussein, recounts what happened on that awful morning last July.
He was waiting for his friends. Prayers would start in 10 or 15 minutes. He would take his phone and play with it until his friends arrived, and then they would go to the mosque together.
I was going to go and pray with him because all my children and myself pray at the mosque. But before I had time to get myself ready for prayers and follow him, my nephew knocked at the door and asked me where Mohammed was. I told him that he was on his way to the mosque, but my nephew replied that Mohammed was not there. As soon as he told me that, I immediately called my son's mobile phone. It rang, but he didn't answer. Then I told my husband to call the police. I was very worried that something had happened to my son because he didn't answer any of my calls, and I had tried many times.
Shiafat is a middle-class Arab area of East Jerusalem. Despite the growing tensions all around, life goes on here. And it's a close-knit community, not the kind of place where you'd expect kidnappings to happen. Yet, according to Mohammed's best friend and cousin, Hakim, this was the second time in 24 hours that strangers had tried to snatch a child off the streets.
There was a kidnapping attempt the day before Mohammed was kidnapped for a mother and her child nearby. So my father prevented me from going out the next day.
It seems that it was purely a case of wrong time and wrong place for Mohammed. The men who abducted him were simply looking for a lone Palestinian youth who they could snatch quickly and with the least resistance. Slightly built and solitary, Mohammed would have fitted the bill as the men's car passed by.
The killer Nazi settlers saw him by himself. They were in a car and were stopping at the traffic lights. Then they reversed and parked the cars on the side of the road and asked him the way to Tel Aviv. Two of them attacked him, put their hands around his mouth as he started screaming. The car was parked on the side and they forced him into the car.
So normally he would have been with friends, but he was by himself, and you think that was at least part of the reason why he was selected?
If he was with his friends, they wouldn't have dared to go out of the car, because in the investigation the settlers said that when they saw a group of guys, they didn't risk going near them because they felt afraid. If we saw an older man, we would never think of doing something. We were waiting for a child to abduct. That's what they confessed in the investigation.
Hussein tells me that as soon as the family realized that Mohammed was missing, they called the police. But they weren't happy with the response they got.
It was 4:10 a.m. when we called the police.
He had been kidnapped 5 minutes before our call. We gave them Mohammed's number, but instead of tracking him, they started interrogating us about his friends, whether we have any enemies and what Mohammed was wearing. Silly questions like that. It proves that they were covering up the issue. They weren't interested in tracking him and following the abductors. They started asking us questions like, who saw him? Where are the cameras? Instead of chasing them, they were looking for the CCTV cameras to sabotage them and to cover up the evidence. So we recorded a copy of the video from the footage on my phone. Otherwise, we would have lost this video that the shop's CCTV filmed. If it wasn't for our cameras, which filmed the incident, the Israeli police would have said the killers were anonymous and the case would have been abandoned. The police wouldn't have searched.
The Abu Qadirs, like many other Arab citizens here, don't trust the police. So, using his mobile phone, Hussein recorded a copy of the CCTV footage the officers were watching before they took it away. Even though Muhammad's body was found within a few hours, the Abu Qadirs believe his discovery was more luck than judgment. They claim that rather than rushing off to find him, the police spent much of their time spreading rumours that he'd disappeared after a family dispute. But police spokesman Mickey Rosenthal insists that, as in all emergencies of this kind, every effort was made to trace Muhammad as quickly as possible.
The Israeli police continue and carry out police operations on all levels, both on criminal as well as terrorist levels. There's no differentiation whatsoever whether it takes place within the Israeli Arab community, the Muslim community, or the Christian community, or the Jewish community. A case is a case. This was obviously a high priority case. Every means and every tool necessary within the Israeli police was used in order to find the suspects. But there is full cooperation, and it's a top priority for the Israeli police both to prevent such cases as well as to get to the killers and to the suspects as quick as possible.
But Muhammad's parents don't only question the police investigation into their son's death. They also insist, despite all the evidence, that 16-year-old Naftali and his two Israeli friends weren't actually murdered at all. Instead, Muhammad's parents believe the Israeli government used the boys' accidental deaths to fuel their propaganda war against Palestinians.
The tension here only started after the kidnapping of the three soldiers, which was just an act played out by the Israeli government. These soldiers weren't killed and died in a car accident in Eilat, and then they were buried in Hebron. Until that moment, nobody confessed that they were killed. The Israeli government was the one to have created these problems.
But if it was a car accident, why would it be made to look like murder? What would have been the point for those people behind it doing this?
They wanted to bomb Gaza and wanted to do any operation to use it as a justification. As you know, this government feeds off settlements, killing and slaughter. This government doesn't want peace.
And how widespread is this belief here? Do many people share your view?
Everybody knows this story, not only us. We didn't come up with the story. Everybody knows the story.
Hamas has admitted, the chairman of Hamas has admitted that Hamas members were involved.
I'm not a politician. I'm an ordinary man and didn't hear of this story. The story that we know is that they died in a traffic accident.
I've seen no evidence whatsoever to support the Abu Qadir's view, popular though it may have been on some social media sites. Hamas has claimed responsibility for the abductions, and the BBC has no reason to doubt that the three Israeli teenagers were murdered after being kidnapped. But the fact that many Palestinians believe these rumours shows the depth of distrust that has developed between them and the Jewish population here. The Cross Jerusalem city train that passes through Shuafat is disliked by many local Palestinians because it links Jewish communities in the east and west of the city. Hussein Abu Qadir remembers how local protests after his son's murder brought this, along with local traffic, to a halt.
On the first day, the Israeli police took me for questioning at 5:36 a.m. and released me at 3 p.m. That afternoon, the young men closed Shofar down and stopped the train. They were angry and closed down the roads without orders from anybody. The army started firing and injured around 70 young men, not to mention the ones they arrested. Even now, some of Muhammad's friends are still in prison.
We didn't have any problems before. Shafat was calm, there were no police. But now after the incident happened, clashes not only happened in Shafat, it spread it all around Jerusalem. But before the incident, everything was calm.
I'm on my way towards Jerusalem Forest, on the outskirts of the city where Muhammad was brutally murdered. According to forensic evidence, he burnt to death after his killers poured petrol over him and set him on fire. We've just arrived by the side of the road in the middle of a forest on the edge of Jerusalem to the spot where Muhammad's body was found and where, in fact, he was murdered. And his father is now putting flowers down. It's not an area that's particularly secluded or covered by trees. It's really quite open. And it's amazing this could happen right by the road that runs past me here.
The family has come here to tend a small memorial of flowers and rocks they had made for Muhammad. But they find that everything has been removed. I must warn you that you may find some of what you're about to hear disturbing.
Last time I planted flowers and I put the stones and put up pictures, but there's nothing when I came here today. They took them out.
Muhammad's father is now bashing in a poster of Muhammad onto the side of a tree overlooking where his body was found. I understand that people have been destroying the flowers and the stones that you've left here in memory of Muhammad.
The neo-Nazis and the Zionists come and take out what we plant here. I want the memorial to be built with cement and I want to put iron rods around it so to prevent them from destroying it.
She's saying, I wonder how they did it, what kind of a heart they had, or what kind of a mind they had to do that. If it wasn't for us and the doctor we brought, then we wouldn't have been able to prove that he was burnt while he was alive. The doctor proved that he was burnt from his legs first. So she's saying, why did they have to burn him while he was alive? Why did it have to be that severe? During the investigation, one of the perpetrators said that they kicked him three times, one for each young man that was killed in Hebron. And then they poured fuel on him, and then they burnt him from the leg up. So they meant to torture him. They meant to make him suffer.
In November, the three people accused of murdering Muhammad appeared for a plea hearing at the district court in East Jerusalem. The main defendant, 29-year-old Yusuf Haim Ben David, declined to respond to the charges due to what was described as his inability to communicate. The other two, who are both minors, denied the charge of premeditated murder. Two of the three were also charged with the attempted kidnapping of a 7-year-old Palestinian boy the previous night. Earlier this month, a 3-judge panel began hearing evidence in the case against the three men. And on January the 6th, an Israeli military court sentenced the man convicted of masterminding the murders of Naftali, Gilad and Eyal to 3 life sentences. Hussam Hassam Kouazmi had earlier confessed to planning and financing the attack.
It's now nearly a week since I came here to the site where Muhammad's body was found with his parents here in Jerusalem Forest. They came to relay a memorial to him. Now everything has gone again. Just to my right, down this steep bank, the flower pots that his parents put there have been thrown right down to the bottom there, and they're now lying upside down. The posters of him on 2 trees just over here, they've been ripped down, and nothing remains now at all.
there is little doubt that the slaughter of these four innocent and like-minded boys proved a catalyst for the deaths and injuries of thousands more people last summer. All further poisoning the already fractious relations between their two communities. Yet Avi Frankel insists that Israel's fight is only with those committed to violence, and not the Arab or Palestinian communities.
I guess there's a direct line starting from the kidnapping and the murder to the war, but it had nothing to do specifically with these three boys, which one of them is our son. That's Hamas, and you have to deal with him. Whoever wants to talk will talk, but if people attack us, if people shoot at our cities and kill civilians, then there's no other way but to react.
And Mohammed's father, Hussein, believes that his people's quarrel with Israel isn't confined to those who killed his son. Now, in his area of East Jerusalem, he says, it's become very much bigger than that.
Before Muhammad's martyrdom, everything was normal. I mean, the relationship with the Jews, the Israelis, was normal. Now, Arabs don't buy from the Jews anymore, and the Jews stopped coming here. Burning Muhammad sabotaged relations completely. Coexistence with Israelis is very difficult.
It seems the killing of the four boys has done nothing but widen the gap between the two communities, filling it with yet more hatred and bitterness. There's no way either family can recover what they've lost, but both are determined to keep the memories of their sons alive.
We want to gain our old life back. Of course, Naftali is not with us, but we want to be a natural family and get back to the place we were before. I don't know if it will work out. I have no idea how the state will be in 5 years or how we will be and what will happen. But that's our goal, to live a normal life.
Keeping Naftali alive amongst us is a challenge. On the one hand, we want him to be there everywhere with the flow of the family and to always be present with us. On the other hand, we don't want to constantly remind ourselves of the void. It's there. There's no way to avoid the void. You know, it's a delicate balance, and we're learning. We're beginners.
Since he was young, he was special to me. There were things in him that would make you like him easily. As he grew up, he started getting closer to me. In the house, we weren't like mother and son. We were more like friends. He was closest to me and used to like sitting on my lap. Until the time he became a martyr, he used to sit in my lap. I never felt he had grown up. To me, he was still a baby.
I'm Mike Thompson, and you've been listening to The Lives and Deaths of Naftali and Mohammed. The producer was Julie Ball.